let me tell you of the story of a man named Charlie on a tragic and fateful day. He put 10 cents in his pocket, just his wife and family went to ride on the MTA. Well, did he ever return? No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned. What a pity. He may ride forever neath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned. Charlie handed in his dime at the Kendall Square station, and he changed for Jamaica Plain. When he got there, the conductor told him one more nickel. Charlie couldn't get off of that train. But did he ever return? No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned. He may ride forever neath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned. Now all night long, Charlie rides through the station crying, what will become of me? How can I afford to see my sister in Chelsea or my cousin in Roxbury? But did he ever return? No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned. He may ride forever neath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned. Charlie's wife goes down to the Scully Square station every day at 2:15. And through the open window she hands Charlie a sandwich as the train comes rumbling through. But did he ever return? No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned. He may ride forever neath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned. Look at Davey. Now, you citizens of Boston, don't you think it's a scandal how the people have to pay and pay? Fight the fare increase, vote for George O'Brien, get poor Charlie off the MTA. Or else he'll never return, no, he'll never return, and his fate is still unlearned.
Just like Paul.
He may ride forever neath the streets of Boston. He's the man who'll never return. He's the man who'll never return. He's the man who'll never return. Hey to Charlie.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A special musical interlude to bring us in for a very special reason. Alan?
Yes. The woman who wrote that, Jacqueline Steiner, wrote that song in 1949 for a socialist candidate running for mayor. It was a throwaway song. She didn't... It was like the ship who never returned, and it was a play on an older song, and it took the country by storm. And she's 95, and she died, and she'll be known for Charlie on the MTA.
She died yesterday.
Yep,
at the age of 95. So we play that this morning. Good morning, everybody. Welcome. It's Thursday, the 31st of January, and very nice to have you all with us on this frigid day. And hopefully you are warm and you are safe, and that is all we can ask for you this morning. We will do our best here to try to ignite some interesting conversation, and we do so with a wonderful panel. Let me introduce them to you now. We have Fran Berman with us, who is the Edward Hamilton Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPA and a faculty associate of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Good morning, Fran Berman.
Good morning. Hope everybody's staying warm.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, a delight to have you, as always. Hey, why are you here? Aaron Pisitti is with us. He's a Siena College economics professor who is a Friday regular, but he couldn't make Friday. But he could make Thursday, yeah.
So sorry, everybody, if you think it's the weekend coming.
No, good to have you here whenever you can be here, and we're thrilled.
Thanks.
Hey, we have a newbie on the panel, too. Let's welcome the new guy. Robert Griffin is here. He is the founding dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. What could we possibly talk to him about? Good morning, sir. How are you?
Very well. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
It is a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us. And we talked to him once, but we'll talk to him again. Dr. Alan Chartek is with us. Good morning, sir.
Hey.
All right. So we remind you that you can be a part of our conversation by simply writing us. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we would love, as always, to hear from you get an idea of what's on your mind. Okay, so the big story, of course, is we were talking yesterday about the intelligence agencies coming out and saying that there is a growing chorus of intelligence officials who are saying that they disagree with the President of the United States. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Then the President decides to go after them, and he did that, lashing out at government's most senior intelligence leaders. Latest assault on the spies and analysts who work for him, but sometimes deliver facts that he does not want to hear. Triggering the president's rage was an annual congressional hearing on global security threats, a routine event at which intelligence agency heads testified that Iran, while still a global menace, is complying with an international agreement to suspend its development of nuclear weapons. Trump ridiculed that assessment and the intelligence leaders themselves. Quote, "The intelligence people seem to be extremely passive and naive when it comes to the dangers of Iran. They are wrong. They are testing rockets last week and more and are coming very close to the edge. Their economy is now crashing, which is the only thing holding them back. Be careful of Iran." So he did call them naive and went on at a few other statements. A lot of this has to do with the Iran nuclear deal, but a lot of it has to do just with a overall distrust of the people that he chose.
Exactly, Joe.
That he chose to be on his national security staff. Okay, so who would like to? Robert, you want to start us off on this?
Well, but he's Robert, give us a little bit of your background just so everybody will understand exactly where you're coming from and what you know. Go ahead.
Sure, thank you. I came to the university in 2017 to help stand up this new college, but I came from the Department of Homeland Security where I helped run their science and technology directorate. So I was acted as a science advisor for the secretary and working with the national security staff. And then I came from the field of first response and both fire.
You were at 9/11, weren't you?
At 9/11, I was one of the fire chiefs that sent, I think, 200 firefighters and paramedics and 50 pieces of equipment into the Pentagon. My jurisdiction was just right outside of Dulles Airport, so I have both the local and the federal experience bringing it to Albany.
Well, I'm proud of you.
So Trump would consider you unqualified to speak on this subject, then, is what I'm hearing.
That I would have to go back to school.
Yeah, probably.
That's right. Really heroic.
Well, it's so interesting because we have a room full of professors here. And I have immense respect for you and for what you're doing. It's fantastic. You don't have a PhD?
I do.
Oh, you do have a PhD.
Yeah, my PhD is from Virginia Tech.
There goes my thesis in a cocktail.
What's your thesis?
My thesis is sometimes the people who know the most about things are not PhDs. Know what I mean?
Wrong.
I knew you'd say that.
That was a joke, by the way.
Everyone. Yeah, I got it. Well,
you can know a lot and you can have a PhD, and sometimes they're connected and sometimes they're not.
Sometimes they're not. Sometimes you read from your notes and sometimes you've done it. And so I think that becomes my experience with students, I don't know about the rest of you, is that if you've actually kept your paw in and done some things and are on the scene, that's what those are people they listen to maybe a little bit more carefully than somebody who's just turning over the notes. You know what I mean?
The ability to interpret theory to practice, I think, is incredibly important when you can connect that for a student or, in the case of the intelligence community, when they can start to show the interconnectivity of the work that they do to the operations, that's what it's supposed to be doing. That's what we're supposed to be doing.
No, I didn't even know that SUNY at Albany, where I worked for a lot of years, had such a center. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. We are we're actually the fourth largest school at UAlbany right now.
Really?
We stood up in 2015 by the governor. It's the first school that's dedicated to all aspects of emergency preparedness, homeland security, and cybersecurity. And we're up to 1,000 majors.
Wow.
That's really
so
impressive.
It's and there's sort of three elements of success for me, for our students. One is the the strong academic skills you get, the understanding of theory. The second is that there's professional development that you need to accomplish 100 hours plus internships. So that idea of building into the curriculum the applied aspects, working in the field aspects to supplement the great academic experience you receive is important. And our students are coming out and they're getting jobs.
So you're an expert. Do you feel, looking at the situation which Joe led in with today, that this is a very dangerous thing, that our national intelligence apparatus is being undermined?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly dangerous. The intelligence apparatus is and has been very, very neutral as far as politics, that they come and they give their best advice to whomever is sitting either in Congress or as president. These are immensely qualified individuals. Their staffs work tirelessly on behalf of the country, and to basically dismiss what they're saying because it didn't agree completely with what you were saying creates a terrible environment two ways. First, you got to speak truth to power, particularly in the intelligence field where there are so many moving parts and there's so many variables that they're bringing together. The second element is that once you start to diminish the legitimacy of our intelligence community, it creates voids in the system that our adversaries, and we have significant adversaries, will try to take advantage of.
So when you look at somebody like Dan Coats, this is not exactly a flame-throwing Democrat. This is a Republican senator, former senator, who was chosen by this president of the United States. And when he speaks this way, it's quite damning.
Very much so. And if you made the comment a little earlier, and I need to go back to this for our listeners. Everyone on that committee is an appointee of the current administration. There isn't any holdovers from a different administration.
Right.
So these are his own people. And when your own people are saying this and then you're saying, oh, you need to send him back to school, it raises some significant questions. And I can say for Dan Coats' point, he is incredibly well-respected on both sides of the aisle. He's got amazing experience. And he really is the glue that holds the intelligence community together.
When you see people like Mattis, you see people like Kelly who get up and say, all right, I've done what I can. I'm gone. I mean, you only assume that these people are going to start to pair off, right?
But yeah. Don't you think that the interesting thing about this is not just that, people are leaving, but people are starting to push back. Congress is starting to push back. The intelligence community is starting to push back. And with the basically equivalence of respect with, letting the stakeholder, the leader, say their thing and then be upset in private. Having people push back publicly seems like a big deal.
It is, but sometimes part of our government is designed for this check and balances, and what the intelligence community did with Congress the other day is just in keeping with how the Constitution set up our government.
Yeah.
So this idea that they did something wrong or they were naive, frankly, is a misunderstanding of the intricacies of how the system works. The other point that I think is really important to make is that these are not folks that come up and shoot from the hip. That every word that they said was carefully crafted. And the interesting thing enough is I'm sure it was shared with the national security staff, because every time that even I had to go up to testify, it was all cleared through not only the department but also the White House. So there's sort of confusion on my part about, okay, who's clearing this information, who's talking to who, and who's not talking to who. But
why doesn't the president have to go through the same
That's funny.
Protocol?
So I can't speak to the current administration.
Good question.
Good joke.
But Joe, I think it's really important to understand that most of the time in the past, at least working with the Obama administration, is that they were very careful and thoughtful with the choice of words, because words matter. And even simple nuances send really clear message to our allies and adversaries about what the country is doing. And these tweets and this approach is creating confusion globally.
And the other interesting thing is that they didn't say the president should do this or that he shouldn't do that. They just kind of laid out a fairly
the way it was.
Factual analysis of what their agencies decided. It wasn't a criticism of Trump. It was, these are our findings, period.
Well, moving off that particular thing, but in a related subject, when Mattis left the administration, General Mattis left the administration, I said, well, there goes another one. It turns out that most of the people that who have been commenting on this, including a lot of Republicans, think this was a huge deviation for the Trump administration. In other words, unlike so many of the others, Mattis really mattered.
So if you remember, he loved his generals at the beginning.
President Trump.
Yeah, and I had the pleasure of actually serving for a period of time under General Kelly as Secretary of Homeland Security, and he's somebody who I absolutely respect, and I respect Secretary Mattis as well. You know, the scary comment that I continue to go back on is that they were sort of the canaries in the coal mine.
Sure.
The thing that people need to remember is that sometimes it took the coal miners longer to pass after the canary did, so it's not always instantaneous.
That's funny.
And the feeling, the concern, I think, is that who is providing that counterbalance to sort of late night whims and whimsies?
John Bolton, unfortunately, seems to be doing it.
And even there's, you know, just from the press, there's a lot of talk about the infighting in the West Wing, and what does that mean? But again, we're sending mixed messages globally.
And I mean, I think this gets back to just a very anti-intellectual administration, where if what you say doesn't agree with what I think, then it's wrong, instead of a more nuanced, fact-based approach where there's discussion, dialogue, and compromise. This is a, I don't like what you're saying. This clashes with what I've been thinking. You're wrong. I'm not even sure
it's what I've been thinking. It's what I think right now. Sure. Because those things change instantaneously.
Absolutely.
And these guys, when Trump says what he's saying, he's playing out of a different rule book than the ones that you guys are talking about, people are talking about. I mean, you know, there's norms and there's this and that. He says it doesn't work. My way works.
But it's not even norms. It's just facts and observation.
It's also norms, in my opinion.
Okay. Well, sure, there's norms in how he approaches it. But I think the foundation is based on, you know, research and analysis that stretches back decades, not just with Trump's appointees.
I think Bob's point is, and which is why I say norms, is that when you deviate from those norms and you shoot from the hip and you don't use, factual analysis, you are basically setting up the enemies of the United States. And certainly Putin falls into that category.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the point where you're both correct and what needs to be remembered is that when you start talking about creating national policy, there are so many twists and turns and intricacies. It's a world of gray. Nothing is ever completely black and white, and every good policy has bad impacts in some sectors. And being able to really think through what that means, and this is part of the reason why the federal government is sometimes it's better for it to go slow, because when you go fast, you can trash whole areas of your economy or really impact negatively whole regions of the world.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. Obviously, we welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org. That's where you can write to us. panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Robert Griffin, Aaron Pasitti, and Fran Berman all on the panel this morning. We'll be right back after this short break.
Out street light down at the end of the road. Sometimes I go out there when I wanna be alone. It's only in the middle of the night, so you won't hear that door close.
Lulu Wilds is who we're listening to this morning, performing at the Ashokan Center's Winter Hoot this Saturday. The Hoot takes place Friday through Sunday. To learn more, and this is perhaps the best URL we've ever said on the program, Hoot, Hoot.love.
Oh,
is that great?
That's good.
Hoot.love.
Reminds me of an owl I once knew.
Lulu Wiles. And What Will We Do is the name of the album, and Lulu will be part of the Ashokan Center's Winter Hoot that is happening on Friday through Sunday.
That would be good.
Huh?
I want to be Fran.love.
Yeah, that great? So yeah. Hoot.love. All right. We got all excited talking to everybody. We forgot to mention the lockbox. The lockbox is doing well. I think Alan has a figure in front of him.
Actually, I don't, and I'm so. Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do. Yeah, there it is. Okay, so we have now raised, drum roll. Okay, that's good. $515,093. Ladies and gentlemen, I never thought I'd see it, but we are now capable of going into a fund drive with a lockbox with $600,000 in it. And that will be the first time, and it will really mean that when we want to talk about the kinds of things that we're talking about today, we can do it, and we can get this thing done in a day. So we have to get to the $600,000 point, and that means about, what, Joe, $75,000 more? No, $85,000. Yeah, I'm good at that. $85,000.
Thank you, economist. Thank there.
That's $11,000 an hour between now and the close of business. About,
yeah, well, we really want to do it by the end of this week. Biggie. And then we can have a good weekend, and then we'll begin the fund drive and end it on the first day, and that would be something else again.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it?
Amazing.
So we have this, we have today, tomorrow, and then all of next week.
And so what's that phone number again, Joe?
1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-9262, or WAMC.org, WAMC.org. Let's go to some letters, Alan.
Well, okay, but first, let me just say, will somebody start us out, you know, with maybe a challenge or something like that that can make this go even faster? Okay, so Stephen said, Intel community, just denigrating the intelligence community by any other president would be impeachable. With Trump, it's just one more outrage going into the chaos stew. And that's from Steve. Okay, thank you, Steve, for that. And then we also heard from Vincent, who said, Trump intelligence. Isn't that an oxymoron? So there you go. Trump intelligence, dear panel. If Trump is being incongruous with his own intelligence agencies, then where is he getting his information from? That might be the most worrying part of all of this. Thank you, said the incomparable Vinny from Kingston. And that's what I got, Joe.
All right. Let's go to other topics and all kinds of things to talk about this morning, unless anybody had anything else that they wanted to get to on intelligence. Anybody want to go on that? So, Aaron, you were going to make the connection between this and the economic impact as well.
Sure. So, I mean, what Trump's doing with his intelligence community is kind of parallel to what he's doing with his economic staff in terms of, the intelligence community is saying what Trump doesn't want to hear. Trump's lapdog economic advisors are saying exactly what he wants to hear, and that is things are just going to be wonderful from now until 2024. Kevin Hassett, the chair of his Council of Economic Advisors, who is in charge of providing economic advice and data to the president. The Council of Economic Advisors makes economic forecasts based on economic policy. So before I start criticizing this, all forecasts are based on assumptions. It's an art. It's a science at the same time. But what the White House is forecasting is that economic growth is going to be about 3% every year from now until 2024. The U.S. economy hasn't experienced a consistent run of growth that strong in a really long time, probably going back to the 1960s, maybe a little bit in the 80s. The interesting thing here, though, is that, I mean, Trump's looking for justification that his, $1.5 trillion tax cut is actually working, that his increases in federal spending are going to stimulate the economy. The interesting thing is that every major other economic forecasting group, including the Federal Reserve, the Congressional Budget Office, and virtually every major bank on Wall Street, has growth forecasts that are about half of what the Trump administration is projecting.
Aaron, can I ask you a question about that?
Sure.
So they're all using models and data, and it can't be the same because, you know, obviously then they'd get the same answers. Are they transparent about that? I mean, how do we know the issue actually is?
The Federal Reserve and the Congressional Budget Office do have fairly transparent macro models. The Council of Economic Advisors doesn't, to my knowledge. Obviously, okay. Wall Street banks, that's all proprietary. But the Fed and the Congressional Budget Office do make, you know, they might not give you the actual computer program, but you know what goes into their models.
Because, you know, as we
also remember that Kevin Hassett, the chair of his council, Trump's chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, forecasted that in 1999, the Dow should be at 36,000.
Uh-huh.
And does everybody remember what happened a couple years after that?
Toilet.
Yeah, toilet. So this is somebody Hassett has made a career on over-optimistic forecasts that are proven wrong. And it really gives honest economists a bad name because there's no cost to making forecasts that are wrong. You can always justify it and say, well, this didn't happen, that didn't happen, so that's why I'm wrong. But if you're wrong for decades by, you know, just overshooting the margin, at some point you would think there would be costs and consequences to this, but apparently there's just benefits in terms of being appointed to, head economist positions.
Go ahead. No, please, Fred.
No, but as we say in data land, you know, garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
So it'd be kind of nice to look at what they're looking at and whether you actually trust predictions they're making.
I'm 85% certain on this, that Trump's economic team is looking at – they're making really rosy forecasts about the effects of his tax cut. And most economists say that the stimulative impact of that was felt primarily in 2018, and it's gone. They're expecting this – you know, they're expecting more business investment because of the lower corporate tax cut. They're expecting more consumption because of lower personal taxes. And when you start to get in the weeds of that, you're just not seeing that. Business investment hasn't grown as much as Trump's economic team has forecasted after the tax cut. Wages aren't rising as rapidly as they forecasted. You're just not seeing this. And I think they're saying, well, it's going to happen. And Wall Street and the Fed and the Congressional Budget Office and most every other self-respecting economist says that's just not going to happen.
But then why don't they just improve the models? Because real data gives you a way to improve.
Because Trump doesn't
models.
Want good models. He wants to hear what he wants to hear. This is going back to the discussion we had about the intelligence community.
Yeah,
he wants to hear things that make him happy. And these people know not to bite the hand that feeds them.
Yeah. Well, when you're talking about the team, we had a little bit of a discussion off air about whether or not the Fed is on the team.
Okay.
Now, my sense of it is that our Fed Chairman Powell was saying his thing and sticking to his guns, and now all of a sudden he's reversing himself. We see a gigantic leap in the stock market when it really counts. When some of these other gazebos or whatever you want to call them say their things, who cares? But when the Fed says something, everybody reacts to that, salutes. So the real question is Powell being an honest broker or is he doing what this president wants him to do?
So remember, Powell is a Trump appointee.
Sure.
Powell is a moderate Republican when it comes to economic policy, at least. So the Federal Reserve is probably the most important economic institution in the world. They're an independent central bank, which means they do not have to answer to Congress. The chair, Powell, is appointed by the president. Members of the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee are appointed and confirmed. But they do not have to answer to Congress. They operate independently. And the point of that is it's to control the country's money supply and the supply of credit.
Aaron, I'm sorry for interrupting, but you say do not have to. But I think that there are legal requirements of what they do. And then there's also who needs Trump spewing his poison out about you on a tweet in the morning?
Sure. I mean, the chairman of the Fed makes a testimony on the state of the economy to Congress twice a year. So they do keep Congress and the president informed about what's going on, but Congress can't, and nor can the president, veto any Federal Reserve policy regarding interest rates. So here's my hypothesis. In 2018, the Federal Reserve made it very clear that the economy was strengthening and that they were going to engage in a very consistent interest rate increase pattern, very small, like 0.25 percentage points every quarter for this foreseeable future.
And what would that achieve? Because a lot of people say, okay, well, what does that do?
So when the Fed raises interest rates, commercial loans, business loans, consumer loans follow that same general trajectory. So if the Federal Reserve raises interest rates on car loans are going to go up, interest rates on mortgages are going to go up.
And
so the point of raising the interest rate is to kind of slow the economy down so we don't get increasing inflation. That's the goal. When the Fed lowers interest rates, it's to stimulate the economy and to encourage business investment because borrowing costs are cheaper. But getting back to your point about whether Powell's a lapdog, I think that when the Fed made this announcement that they were going to increase interest rates for the foreseeable future, Fed officials test the water with public statements to see how markets are going to react. And this would have been, fall of 2018 when Powell made some fairly bold announcements about the Fed's interest rate plans. Markets didn't like that. That's when you started to see the massive volatility in stock markets. But Powell and the Fed pay attention to a lot more than just market responses. You see slowing growth in China. You see slowing global growth in general. You have the government shutdown. You have this looming trade war with China. You have rewritten trade agreements. All of this creates a lot of uncertainty, and nobody's exactly sure where that's going to end up. So I think Powell just kind of floated out something to see what would happen. And when he saw what happened during the Fed's meeting Tuesday and Wednesday, they said maybe raising interest rates isn't the right idea. So they backed off the policy of we're going to just continue to raise interest rates. And I think that's the right choice. I do agree with – I will go on the record saying – Trump was right when he said the Fed should ease off interest rate increases because I don't think the economy is strong enough in a lot of dimensions, particularly wage growth, to handle rising interest rates, which would ultimately slow economic growth. So I think Trump was right.
We need to take a break. Let's do that. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We welcome your help in the lockbox, 1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. And we will be right back after this short break.
This land mine, the fault lines crack and the fists they fly in the heat of the night. I touch the falling sky. It's a story as old as the flag in the yard. The money's too tight and the work's too hard. Baby, do you know just who your enemies are?
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Lulu Wiles is the music we're playing and performing at the Ashokan Center's Winter Hoot this Saturday. The Hoot takes place Friday through Sunday, and you can learn more by visiting hoot.love. We have letters, and we would love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org. Go, Alan.
We would. Okay. Good morning, panel. Please talk about the jobs brought back to the U.S. Trump has mentioned on Fox News that he's responsible for thousands of jobs being brought back here, And that's Kathleen, a sustainable member and huge fan of WAMC. So the question, ladies and gentlemen, is whether or not he has brought those jobs in.
So that's a very difficult question to answer because it's tough to tell whether companies would have brought those jobs back independent of who was president or Trump's economic policies. Based on, you know, what's involved in the corporate tax cut, that's mainly allowed firms to boost profits and boost dividend payments to shareholders. It has not resulted in the wage growth that was promised, and I'm willing to bet that it has not led to, sure, some job, like Apple announced they're opening a plant in, what, Austin or something that's going to have 10,000 people. They probably would have done that with or without Trump. So, yeah. No, this is not a reshoring miracle that Trump has promised.
Well, but to argue with you for a minute there, Aaron, what do I know? We know in politics it's if the jobs actually have appeared, the president is going to get the credit
for it
as opposed to not. So to me, the question is, have the jobs appeared?
I mean, job growth. So the unemployment rate is 3.9%, which is very low by historical standards. It hasn't been that low since the late 60s. But if you look at the rate of job creation under Trump relative to Obama, it's actually slower. So the answer is, yeah, he can take credit for a low unemployment rate. I would say non-trivial job creation. But, you know, the economy is like an oil tanker. You can't just make it turn around and pivot, you know, in 30 seconds.
It's been going forward for a while before Trump.
If we don't have a recession before July 2009, this will tie the longest economic expansion in U.S. history at 120 months.
And your prediction is?
Don't ask me that.
Well,
So if you want to know, there's really no red flags that suggest a recession is imminent. There's, you know, Brexit, there's slowing global growth. All of these things conspire, and depending on if they happen at the right time or if Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un doesn't go well and World War III is on the horizon, sure, that might spark a recession. But if you look at basic economic data, there's really nothing to suggest that a recession would be imminent. So, yeah, I think this will become the longest economic expansion in U.S. history, but it has nothing to do with it has very little to do with President Trump's policies.
Well, you know, here's my problem, fellow TIA CREF holders, is this. I don't understand. Maybe you can help me with this. When and this is just impressionistic, that's all it is that when the market dives, I lose a lot. But when the market comes up, I don't gain it all back. It's not, I don't get the same sense out of, now I may be entirely wrong, but what about that?
But doesn't that depend on what you're invested in, Alan?
Yeah, so if you're invested, so if the U.S. stock market goes up and most of your holdings are in, you know, foreign equities, then you're not going to see that bump. If
I have no idea
down.
What I'm invested in. I just look at the thing.
Alan, you have a homework assignment for next week.
I just look at the thing. Okay.
I want a one-page summary of that.
Good morning, panel. Please talk about the Joe. We did that. Okay, there we did. All right. Andre says, dear panel, I'd like to share one observation and one hope. The observation is that if, and I repeat if, Trump was an agent whose objective is to undermine and destabilize the USA, he would not be doing anything differently than he presently is. The hope is that he is an episode of political dysentery that will hopefully pass and perhaps even heighten our resolve to protect what is a very fragile entity, our imperfect democracy, and that's Andre from Taconic. Okay.
Interesting metaphor, Andre.
Bob, yeah, pass.
The country's going to need lots of electrolytes before we recover from this particular bout.
Yeah. Well, but you know, as a guy who really studies this stuff, you know your stuff. I know that about you. Do you subscribe to the idea that there may be some cahoots here between Putin and the president? Talk about putting a guy on the spot. Yeah. Remember the president at U of, but he's listening.
Yes, I hope so. you know, I think what we're going to find is that there may be people around him that have, that are in deeper relationships than they should. I don't know if it's going to go all the way to him. I think, and I worry whether we will ever find out the full facts of the matter. I don't know what's going to be released or what's not. I can say, though, Alan, is that as a student of history, I've never seen a president that has as many disconcerting connections with our adversaries. And that's incredibly worrisome.
I'll take that as a yes. Now, with that in mind, we are all so scared because yesterday's big news was that Trump goes to a meeting with Putin. He brings a translator, and Trump brings a translator too, his wife, and who speaks, you know, fluent Russian. So then the question is, what was going on there?
I can't for a second understand what was going on there. I can tell you that in my life at in the federal government, even when I went abroad to negotiate contracts for or treaties with our foreign allies, I was never alone. I was never alone in the room with folks. We always had handlers. That the State Department was always involved. DHS was always involved. I am actually shocked by that news. Now we have absolutely no record of what was said. We have no understanding of the agreement. We lost huge opportunities at gathering additional intelligence about the thinking of Putin and what Russia's looking for. And that's all part of the power of our intelligence system is the tradecraft. And I'm sorry, but the president does not have that tradecraft. And he needs to surround himself with people who understand and who are experts in these areas. And the country's at a significant disadvantage when he does this.
Now, there are those people who think, Bob, for whatever it's worth, I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist myself, but there are those people who think that Putin, for some reason, has something on Trump or owns Trump. And, you know, now we have the spectacle of his wife coming with him to this, and one wonders about what the portent of that may mean. Put another way, I don't like to mince around about it. Is she a spy? So you know, this just gives more fodder, right, to those people who think that that Trump really is in bed with Putin.
The optics of it are absolutely horrible. And you know, if your intent wasn't to try to make it look like you're in cahoots, you couldn't do much more than you're already doing to appear like you are, you know, this guy's best friend. And the strange part of this is that there seems to be a proclivity with the president towards people who have traditionally been our adversaries at the expense of our own allies and equally important, you know, his own administration's experts.
Well, it also implicates the first lady. You know, if the wrongdoing is found to go to Trump and she's in that meeting, it implicates her.
Yeah. You know, Putin brings a translator and Trump brings his wife.
Yeah.
Sort of interesting in all of this.
Yeah.
You would think that, you know, given the level and intensity of the Mueller investigation, that Trump would be trying to, as Bob said, you know,
better optics. Yes.
Except who's on the other end pulling the other strings. That's the problem.
No, but you would think, I mean, any sensible person would try to kind of shift that, the optics or the dialogue in a way that would perhaps give him some cover.
You need to go back and...
Yeah, anything
read a little
is,
bit
anything
more on blackmail.
Is true from a false assumption.
I know that's the case. I'm just saying reasonable people should do that.
Fran, we should not have talked over you. What were you saying?
Oh, I was saying anything is true from a false assumption. So logically, so if you assume that someone's a reasonable person and they're not a reasonable person, the rest of it is.
I like that. True. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have more letters. We have more topics. We have much more to discuss. We welcome you to help out on the lockbox, WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. We'll be right back after this short break.
You just can't stand.
playing the music of the Lulu Wiles this morning, performing at the Ashokan Center's Winter Hoot this Saturday. The Hoot takes place Friday through Sunday. Learn more at hoot.love. Welcome back to the program. Alan Chartok, Robert Griffin, Aaron Pasitti, and Fran Berman making up the group this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan has a few of those, and then we'll move on to other stuff.
All right. Good morning on this frigid day, says Mary Ann, when you get to Venezuela and to Honduras. Okay. Colombia is accepting thousands and thousands of Venezuelans from oil-rich Venezuela because their government has made the country unlivable. Now Trump all of a sudden is sticking his oar in this ever-brewing situation. I wonder why he completely overlooks our big stick to pressure the leaders of Honduras and Guatemala to clean up their acts. Instead, he uses a relative handful of mothers and children fleeing these small, corrupt, and dangerous countries to destabilize our country. Yet another proof of his treasonous incompetence. And that's Marianne from Bern. All right. By the way we do it here, Bob, is if you have anything to say on anything that comes up in a letter, just come right in.
Thank you. If I could, let me just jump in really quickly on that, because I think it's an interesting point, is that what the administration has done is that it has pretty much cut the majority of our foreign aid programs that in this situation would be incredibly valuable in incentivizing a different behavior by some of our peer countries. And this is, you know, I was talking about the unintended consequences of policy. You know, the cuts to things like USAID and the cuts to the State Department mean that there's more responsibilities on the Department of Defense and therefore on the Department of Homeland Security, that all of these systems
are interrelated. Which is where you hail from.
Exactly. Exactly. But, you know, those cuts in our ability to incentivize behavior that we are looking for to help our country are tools that we don't necessarily have in the quiver the way we have in the past.
Russ says, diminishing returns. If the share of federal spending devoted to interest on the debt increases every year, at what point do we cry uncle? It's not just the entitlements, the discretionary share of federal expenditures include many programs that nearly everyone relies on. Someone needs to project a day of reckoning for HUD, food stamps, etc. Right?
Yeah. You know, so... Yes, the debt burden of the U.S. government is a concern, but interest rates right now are so low that the debt burden is fairly inconsequential.
Do we want to get rid of it?
What?
The debt burden. In other words, do we want to lower the burden so that we don't owe anything?
Remember, the federal government's debt are other people's assets, and a lot of those assets are held by the Chinese, U.S. financial institutions. So if we pay off the debt, meaning if the government pays back the people who have lent it money, those people become wealthier. So if we pay off all of the debt held by China, that would stimulate growth in China, which is a benefit for the U.S. So, you know, to me, the debt burden is fairly inconsequential. Governments run deficits all the time. Businesses operate with huge amounts of debt. That is the way modern capitalism works.
Well, yes, but we spend an enormous amount of our capital on servicing the debt, right?
It's like, I think like some, I could look it up, but it's a single digit percentage. 6% is the number that comes to my head.
Well, 6% of that debt would feed an awful lot of
families. No, I'm saying 6% of all federal spending goes to satisfying the debt burden. That's a remarkably low amount.
Well, that'd feed a lot of families. That would do a lot of social good, wouldn't it, if we spent it on something else?
Sure. But remember, we're acquiring that debt to allow these programs to work to begin with. And the point is that you borrow money today in the hopes that you spend that money wisely so it generates proportionately more growth tomorrow.
Thank you. And Julia said, Fed interest rates. Dear panel, one of the Fed's principal tools to counter an event like the 2008-09 crash is interest rates. The problem is that if interest rates are too low and another recession hits, then there's little margin for stimulation.
That is an excellent point. That's one thing that I meant to mention but forgot, so I'm happy to hear that. Yeah, the Fed really backed itself into a corner with keeping interest rates at zero from 2008 to 2015. So if a recession hits, the Fed has a lot less ammo than they had in the past.
And along those lines, we've heard from Elisa from Point Pleasant, New Jersey. They're listening all over the place to us. Interesting. Thank you for the informative discussion of the Federal Reserve. I've been waiting for long-term savings rates to rise. There was a time in November 2018 when 10-year CDs reached 4%. Now they are back to around 3 to 3.4%. Do you think long-term savings rates will rise, which would be a great help to retirees? And that's from Elisa.
Tough question. The whole point of Federal Reserve policy since the financial crisis in 2008 has been to discourage savings. The point is to get people to spend money or to invest in stocks because they provide a higher return. So until the Federal Reserve dramatically raises interest rates, which is going to slow the economy, interest rates on savings accounts and money market funds, money market funds, all of that are going to remain exceptionally low.
But that's by design.
Not,
by the way, that I'm going to retire, because I'm not. But I am 77
Iron
years
Man.
Old. I'll retire when I die. So my question to you, Aaron, is if you were 77 years old and you had your TIA CREF money in the thing, would you convert everything to cash now in the idea that the big one is coming?
I am not a certified financial planner or advisor. But
with that understood.
But, did you mean a crash or a heart attack?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It depends how much I had.
Too much Sanford and Son in my life.
I would probably be invested in exceptionally safe assets, meaning largely out of stocks and real estate.
Yeah.
I'd invest it all in Bitcoin.
Yeah. You would not. Oh, man, that's a bad idea.
That was the joke, everybody.
Would you invest in
real estate like 666 Fifth Avenue?
Yes, like 666 Fifth Avenue.
The president take care of them. Yeah. Okay. Malignant narcissism. Hello, panel. Our delusional malignant narcissist, sociopath POTUS, creates his own reality and manipulates everyone he can see fit to see it. As real. He will continue to do this until he's removed from office. Impeachment is a process that must be begun. Just a reminder, this man has the nuclear codes, and that's for Maureen. Yes, he does. Dr. Bob?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting part about the letter, though, is that how successful he is, at least with elements of his base and certainly keeping the press jumping, keeping his view of the world front and center.
In the news every day.
Every day. And one of the things I struggle with sometimes is just looking at the poll numbers going, who are these 35%? I mean, what part of this aren't you getting?
And that's, well, who are they?
I don't know.
I know who they are.
I think some of them, not all of them, are thoughtful people who hear their information from really different sources. Really different sources.
Yeah, that may be, but I think, Fran, for whatever it's worth, I think some of them, as you say, are really, some of the...
Don't use that word, Alan.
Yeah, how about this?
They've
always been there. They just finally got a candidate that is...
I agree.
...acting and expressing what they have felt for a long time.
At least since the Civil War.
Yes.
Right.
Or even before.
Okay. So Travis says, though it's obvious logical decision-making isn't a priority for our current leader, what explains Trump and Maduro's stance when he's so permissive to Kim Jong-un? North Korea is a communist dictatorship. Venezuela is a socialist dictatorship. Is his policy-making devised just on a whim, or is there an underlying framework we can point to? Interesting question. We've always been active in South America, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, all the way back to the Monroe Doctrine. I mean, we certainly view it as our own backyard. His relationship, the president's relationship with North Korea is really interesting. The relationship between the military and South Korea and the threat from North Korea has been growing. And I think the president saw an opportunity to step in there. I think we've been played. Honestly, I don't think
played by Kim.
Played by Kim. Yeah. I don't think that they've substantially given us anything that we didn't already have, and we provided North Korea with a level of legitimacy that they have never enjoyed, and it's impossible to put that genie back in the bottle. Part of me also says that there are folks around the president that saw this as an opportunity to be thinking about a Nobel Peace Prize and fundamentally stamping his fingerprints on changing world dynamics. That's why North Korea was so important to him.
Well, Nobel Peace Prize. Can somebody call Jason in here with a basin? Okay, let's see here. Dan says, Trump and foreign policy. Dan here, I wish the media would stop using the word think when discussing Trump and his views of domestic and foreign policy. The only concern for Trump is his own image and perception thereof. He does not think about policy. He thinks about himself.
And his donors.
And from Linda, new panel member. Good morning. I continue to be impressed and gratified with the panelists that come on. I apologize that I don't recall Robert's full name, but I thank you for your insight.
Robert Griffin.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mom, for sending that.
Yeah, take the fan letter with you.
Robert.love.
Or you may just refer to him as Dean, if you like.
That's a different website.
Different website, yeah.
And Jason says, first-time writer. Morning panel. I hope you're all enjoying this beautiful weather. Please comment on the circumvention of the U.S. sanctions on Iran by major EU countries. Seems to be a slap in the face to Trump, especially given the genius's recent comment regarding Iran to his intelligence chief. Appreciated, and that's from Jason.
Yeah. So what we've done is that we have undermined our allies and created an untenable position where they now need to make a choice between their best interests and our best interests because the two interests are now separated. And you see that in stark realization in the Iran situation with companies doing business with Iran, particularly where our allies still feel that the agreement was working, that things were moving in a positive direction. We were the ones that were the outliers, and now we've created a division among what was a rock-solid set of allies.
And Dennis is answering, David is actually answering my question. Alan and friends, remember that when your retirement account goes down 50%, say from 1,000 to 500, for example, it takes more than that percentage to go back up to where you were. A 50% increase in your $500 only brings you back $750. This is not stock market conspiracy. I was just moaning, that's all.
No, good math, though. I like that. He's right.
All right. He is right. I mean,
well, in terms of just
his
use of percentages,
right. Yeah.
Well, so no, I get the percentage part of it, but if I'm sitting there with something in my TIAA-CREF, and there's 2008 and something like that, and then the market goes all the way up to where it was, but my money has not gone all the way up in my particular account, that is somewhat frustrating to me. Don't you see?
Well, again, it depends what you're invested in. If you want your TIAA-CREF portfolio to track the stock market, invest only in an S&P 500 index stock.
Yes. Yes, but when it goes all the way down, it's going down on the backs of the same stocks that have come back. So why wouldn't that happen? Don't you see?
I mean, I see what you're talking about. It just depends where your money is.
Right.
Well,
because it's not homogeneous. All stocks aren't doing the same thing.
It's kind of like inverse to weight, if you think about it. It's really easy to put weight on, but really hard to take it off. Once it goes down, it's really hard to get it to rebuild it back up.
Boy, I'm not happy with you people. Putin meeting.
Don't shoot the messenger, Alan.
Putin meeting, says Jarrett. Hi, Alan. This is Jared emailing from Albany. Can you please discuss how it is ethical for a representative of the American people to be in a closed room as a representative of the people without people even knowing what he is talking about? That is like a person having their mouth say something without their brains knowing about it. The American people should have the right to know exactly what their elected official is saying when he is in the position of being an elected official talking to a foreign power.
So yes and no. I think the American people have the right to know that who the president is meeting with and when, but there are certain conversations that frankly shouldn't be in the public, that as we're starting to think about development of policy, when we're starting to have conversations that frankly you need to have in private so you can work through difference of issues. So the fact that he met with Putin alone that he met with Putin isn't as big an issue to me. It's the fact that he didn't bring the support apparatus that he should have had with him. And that includes, you know, his intelligence folks, our own translators. There's a cast of characters that should have been supporting him in Warren. And that's my biggest issue. I think that the president going to meet with his foreign counterparts is actually important and critical to our foreign policy.
David says, is it possible, back to the market, is it possible to determine whether the rise in the market is fueled by higher production and consumer spending or stock buybacks paid for by tax savings, simply increasing profits with three question marks?
Yeah, it's probably a little bit of both in that, consumption represents 70% of the economy. Wage growth is starting to pick up. The unemployment rate's low. So, yes, the fundamentals do contribute. But, you know, Trump's tax cuts, the massive and which has increased companies' profits. Companies are using those profits to buy back a large amount of their stocks, which pulls stocks off the market, which raises the price of those stocks and increases dividend payments to wealthy stock owners. It's probably both.
Hello, panel, says Tim. I take umbrage to calling Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and other programs entitlements. We as taxpayers have paid into them with every paycheck. They belong to us. Thanks, Tim.
Yep. Nobody calls car insurance an entitlement program. So why is social insurance one?
Good point.
And Gary says, tax and investment question. This is a too long a question, but I'm going to read it, make a rare exception. I have a tax and investment question for Aaron. If a company or billionaire has an income of $10 million and expenses of $5 million, they pay tax on $5 million, correct? If their tax rate were higher, wouldn't that be more incentive to invest? The theory that tax breaks spur investment baffles me. If they have a lower tax rate, wouldn't that encourage them to pocket more of their money? If this is true, why aren't Democrats using FEET, these tax breaks for the wealthy? Maybe defeat? I don't know.
I get the general outline. To a certain extent, that's correct. If, you know, economists have looked at this, there's very little correlation between tax rates, corporate tax rates, and business investment. There's very little relationship. What drives business investment primarily is consumer demand, wage growth, and interest rates to a certain extent. Tax policy just redistributes income among different groups. It has very little effect on business investment. So why why Democrats don't pound that drum? Well, remember, a lot of Democrats are also funded by very wealthy Wall Street bankers. Democrats are beholden to financial interests and the interests of the wealthy to a lesser extent than Republicans. But yeah, that grip is still pretty firm.
Well, but now you have the AOC group and others coming on, the progressives, and they're not going to let some of this policy go unchallenged.
I'm just making a point.
All right. We're out of time.
No.
Points are over. Robert Griffin, thank you very much for
being here.
You
were terrific.
Come back, right? Yeah, excellent. Aaron Pasitti, thank you very much. We won't see you next week. We'll see you the week after.
Yes.
And Fran Berman, we'll see you soon. Thank you very much.
Yes, you always stay warm, everybody.
Always a pleasure. Alan, thank you. Reminder on the lockbox, WAMC.org, and 1-800-323-9262. We'll be right back.